Chapter 4. Philosophic Understanding. Introduction. These kinds of understanding are not neat, discrete categories, each in its distinctive primary color, each marked off definitively from the others. They do not represent irreconcilable features in the minds of their users. They do not represent incommensurable mentalities. In daily life, we think, talk, and communicate using one kind or another, slipping more or less easily from one to another, combining or coalescing one with another. I have referred to them as somewhat distinctive, more like different perspectives than different mentalities, by means of which particular features of the world and experience are brought into focus and prominence in combination. Working with the tools of oral language leads to the set of characteristics, the perspective on the world and experience, the style of sense-making, the kind of understanding I am calling mythic. Oral language use is by far the most prominent influence on, or shaper of, that kind of understanding. The romantic layer is a little more complicated. I have identified it not simply with the tool of alphabetic literacy, but with a cluster of further related social and cultural developments in ancient Greece. This philosophic layer is shaped by an even more diffuse tool, or mediational means. It requires not only a sophisticated language and literacy, but also a particular kind of communication that in turn requires particular kinds of communities or institutions to support and sustain it. The central feature of philosophic understanding is systematic theoretic thinking, and an insistent belief that truth can only be expressed in its terms. I call this kind of understanding philosophic, primarily because it was developed in the program that Plato and Aristotle redefined and bequeathed to the world with such an intimidating weight of intellectual authority. They were magisterial combatants on behalf of, quote, philosophy, or rather a particular style of philosophizing, as the sole repository of the truth in opposition to all comers, end quote. This style reached a further distinctive pitch after ancient Greek texts became again accessible and influential through the European Renaissance. These texts in turn stimulated ramifying intellectual developments, leading to what was unselfconsciously called the Enlightenment and giving birth to what we call the modern world on July 15, 1662. On that day, the Royal Society of London was founded, or rather, on that day it received a charter from King Charles II. And 1662 makes as useful a marker as any for the transition to a clear acknowledgement of science as a central distinguishing element of European civilization. In the Western national meta-narrative, the kind of thinking promoted by Plato and Aristotle, and many others, is seen as an inevitable progress from its predecessors, but we would do well to be wary of the easy patterns of hindsight. Instead, we might focus on the ancient polemical battles in which that particular form of abstract, generalized, theoretic thinking, with its universal ambitions, enjoyed a remarkable victory. It produced a kind of understanding that has proven to have its uses, some of them spectacular, and in educating today we will want to make best use of these. But, like each kind of understanding, it also has its limitations. It includes significant features of other kinds of understanding, and in educating today we will want to be aware of these too. Philosophic understanding is one of an indeterminate set of possible implications of language and literacy development. It is a kind of thinking that did not gain in other ancient civilizations the dominance it won in Greece. That is to say, there is no natural progression in this direction. The reasons for its development have to be sought in the particularities of ancient Greek society and in the aggressive program of a particular group of intellectually talented people. Certain individual imaginations grasped in this direction with tools that gained a hold on something, and they worked energetically to elaborate both the tools and the understanding of the world these tools generated. With hindsight, we can see some of these preliminary tools developing within the Greek language. Bruno Snell has tried to trace what he calls the discovery of the mind in the changes in language from Homer to the time of Plato and Aristotle, and tries to expose in chapter 10 of that book, quote, the origin of scientific thought, end quote. One tool important in the earliest appearance of scientific thinking, he argues, is the development of the definite article in Greek. In the oral past, one might refer to a good goat, or a good rope, or a good bowl. Literacy made the sounds of language into visible marks, which could be manipulated, juxtaposed, and observed in ways that were less easy in an oral world. One might, for example, attach the definite article to an adjective and create a new abstract noun, such as the good. What, one might then ask, do a goat, rope, and bowl have in common by sharing goodness? What is the nature of the good? Referring to Heraclitus, Snell argues that, quote, the waxing power of the article is a prerequisite of its abstractions, end quote. Such linguistic developments help the formation of what we now, as a result, call philosophical problems. This theoretic thinking is not easy, nor is it obvious how such an abstracted use of language can be an effective route to dealing with practical problems. One does see examples of this kind of thinking in other ancient civilizations and in oral cultures, but unique to ancient Greece are the systematic cultivation of this level of discourse and the assertion that it is the only form of language that can capture what is real and true about the world and experience. The difficulty of learning and sustaining this theoretic discourse was in part overcome by communities dedicated to it. Among the earliest was the Pythagorean community at Crotona in southern Italy. It had political and religious aims as well as philosophic and proto-scientific interests, a combination that would have been recognized without any sense of anomaly by the founders of the Royal Society, though the dietary and hygiene rules might have seemed a tad alien in 17th century Britain, as might such Pythagorean injunctions as touch the earth when it thunders, or abstain from beans. The diffuse community of Hippocratic practitioners and writers, trying to forge a rational, proto-scientific approach to medicine, also were prominent in developing theoretic thinking, as were the argumentative law courts of the Ionian cities and of Athens. In these courts, people developed procedures for publicly establishing and verifying the truth about cases. This discourse was carried to and fro between law courts and the disputatious democratic assemblies, where the work of developing knockdown arguments against opposing positions was carried on with urgency. This new kind of thinking tended to undermine the authority of tradition and to encourage a rational reassessment of affairs, enlarging the initiative of merchants no less than of politicians and scholars. Quote, when Tom, Dick, and Harry began to call themselves society and the state and start meddling with the moral deportment of individuals, end quote, the authority of the gods or sacred ancestors and tradition lost ground to individuals analyzing their activities in terms of rational considerations of their interests. Thus, Max Weber sees sophisticated rationality developed as a tool for analyzing the successors of these early developments in capitalist economic activity, bourgeois law, and bureaucratic authority. This rationality, quote, is capable of being expressed in numerical, calculable terms, end quote. Eric Havelock notes as central to the new conceptual language developed in ancient Greece that it is, quote, a counting, calculative use of language akin to arranging units of speech in some new and unrhythmic order, a rationalized language, end quote. Plato's archetypical academic community required its students to be familiar with geometry, an abstract, calculative form of knowledge that established unequivocal truths that were subject to no knockdown response. Communities and institutions in the post-classical world have continued to nurture and develop this kind of theoretical thinking and the philosophic understanding it produces. Communities are important to this kind of understanding because it is carried only in part by philosophic texts. It is, quote, oral discourse about written texts that provides such fertile ground for modern, skeptical, interpretive thought, end quote. Talking about such texts helps to make the abstract language a part of one's everyday thinking, or makes it fluently available when one is confronted by problems or circumstances with which it can effectively deal. The isolated scholar, the antididact, will often engage this level of discourse energetically, but is more likely to become lost or eccentric as a result of manipulating its abstractions than is the scholar in a community. Not that becoming lost or eccentric is so rare among the most clubbable navigators of the philosophic realm. Something about throwing the first stone comes to mind. Ancient Greek and modern European theoretic thinking. Let us return to the new form of historical narrative Herodotus invented and see what happened to it, because the developments in history writing exemplify a more general development of theoretic thinking. For present purposes, two distinct developments can be charted. First is a continuing tradition of romantic histories like Herodotus's. From his time to today, histories of this kind have been most popular. They involve a focus on dramatic events, preserving the memory of great deeds and outstanding people from sliding unjustly into the river of forgetfulness and being carried away, as Anna Komnena put it. From Xenophon's description of his desperate march up country, through Arrian's account of Alexander's life and conquests, up to modern semi-journalistic books on self-immolating cults or serial killers and their trails of mayhem, or hagiography-tinged memorials of outstanding figures or pop singers, the note of romantic history writing persists. Such narratives can be precisely accurate, intricately detailed, and sophisticated in expression. Their expression of and appeal to romantic understanding is evident in their interest in the mega-ergon and their embodiment of various of the characteristics sketched in the previous chapter. The second development was to a significantly different kind of history, such as that written by Thucydides. He wrote about the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta, but unlike in romantic histories, he focused on establishing a more general truth beyond the particulars. He articulated a theory of history as well as a narrative of particular events. Thucydides' ambition to capture some general truth about the historical process, though he may have started with the idea of writing a handbook on strategy, led to one of the stranger books that has survived from the ancient world. It is a carefully researched, massively detailed, dispassionate record of a terrible, passionate war. Thucydides himself, an Athenian general, describes briefly his part in the loss of the city of Amphipolis. He tells us only that he set out as fast as possible with his 7 ships, that it was winter, and that he arrived just too late to prevent the surrender of the city. Later, he notes in passing to explain how he was able to spend so much time researching the details of the war that for his part in this action he was banished for 20 years from his native Athens. There is no exculpation, no apology, no detail relevant to his case beyond what the narrative of the war calls for. This is not what we have come to expect from generals' memoirs of their wars. Thucydides suppresses personal interest in favor of a greater ambition. He begins his history by telling us that we should expect a difficult read. He is not in the business of providing entertainment, like Herodotus, nor something of simply local and immediate relevance, but rather he is writing a book whose value will last forever. He shows us Athens in her glory, under the steady hand of far-sighted Pericles, and then describes her growing confidence in the certainty of success in the war, and her increasing conviction that she was immune to fortune and chance. Influence over the conduct of the war later passes to the unstable Cleon, the most violent of citizens, and to the deluded lion Alcibiades. Thus we follow the city's psychological condition from the richness and confidence of the early years to the unbearable end, prefigured in the greatest and most daring action that culminates in the destruction of Athens' hopes and the flower of her army in a stone quarry in Syracuse. Full of pathos and drama, the war is given the narrative shape of a tragedy. Thucydides' aim was not to record the great and wonderful deeds that should be remembered, except insofar as this was incidental to preventing the whole war from sliding over into myth, as the Trojan War had, left to Homer, or into a romantic, audience-gratifying entertainment, as the Persian Wars had at the hands of Herodotus. Both historians had failed to recognize the proper aim of history, which was to establish the truth, not just about a particular war, but about war in general. Thucydides seemed to believe that war was like a disease, and as we can trace the symptoms and course of a disease, like the Hippocratic writers on medicine, so we can establish how war occurs in human affairs. He uses an odd phrase to modern ears, claiming that he is going to describe this war in detail so that, quote, when similar events recur as they will, human nature being what it is, people will be able to recognize them, end quote. That is, it is as though the Peloponnesian War is serving as a paradigm of wars, the underlying structure of which his investigation exposed. Like Hippocratic medical researchers, Thucydides clearly has a nascent scientific ambition, the discovery of a general law determining the course of human affairs. Thucydides seems to have seen history not as a set of diverse particular events, but rather as a single complex process whose underlying order, rules, or laws could be exposed by careful, dispassionate inquiry. His ambition has been shared by many since. We call them metahistorians, or philosophers of history, in the 19th century sense of those who focus on exposing some general truth about the historical process as a whole, that this is a tragic process, or an ameliorating process, or one involving the organic birth, maturity, and death of civilizations. A more familiar source of theoretic thinking is medicine. The Hippocratic writings certainly aim to establish general truths about their phenomena of interest, even though some of their prescriptions seem no more likely to affect cures than those dispensed in the temples by priests, according to God's diagnoses. The Hippocratic prescription for moving a misplaced womb, for example, involved the patient crouching alternatively over sweet and foul odors to encourage movement in one direction or another. Lloyd describes the canon of writings as involving, quote, dogmatism, arbitrariness, and wild speculation, end quote, often indistinguishable from the folk medicine they were attempting to displace. But their approach exhibits a sputtering commitment to something we cannot but recognize as the beginnings of rational, scientific medicine. There is particularly the appeal to what we would call empirical principles, as the author of On Ancient Medicine put it, quote, hence I claim that it has no need of empty postulates such as are inevitable in dealing with insoluble problems beyond the reach of observation, for example, what goes on in the sky or beneath the earth. If a man pronounces some opinion he has formed on how these things are, it cannot be clear either to himself or to his hearers whether what he says is true or not, for there is no test that can be applied so as to yield certain knowledge, end quote. Certainly, the Greeks did not invent medicine as they did not invent geometry or astronomy, but they were, quote, as far as we know, the first to engage in self-conscious analysis of the status, methods, and foundations of those inquiries, the first to raise precisely the second-order questions, end quote. And they were the first to organize institutions to support and further this straining, complicated kind of inquiry. No doubt many folk remedies or contemporary pharmacopoeia might contain as good or better practical help for the sick. What they did not seek to develop, which the Hippocratics did, was a body of theory. Another feature of this new method was that it encouraged a disengaged perspective. More radically than the rationality of romantic understanding, this philosophic method encouraged its communities of users to grasp things not as they impinge on their interests, but as they are in reality. We have become very knowing about the difficulties in achieving such a grasp on reality, of course. But pursuing it, trying to attain it, has led to a rather odd program of inquiry, with surprising results, in which people began to inquire into all kinds of things that have no pragmatic interest or value, or serve no one's apparent social purposes. Inquiry was constrained only by what the available methods of inquiry did not allow. So the swing of the Pleiades, or the behavior of ants, became as interesting, or more interesting, to these calculating theory makers than one's daily cares. An epistemologically omnivorous form of inquiry resulted, one which, its proponents polemically proclaimed, could deliver the truth about the world. Plato, and more comprehensively Aristotle, spelled out the conditions for attaining this new kind of philosophic understanding. Crucial was the elimination of the poetic from inquiry. The arts only introduced vagueness and turned the focus to matters that the new calculative methods could not grasp. Metaphor, intuition, images, and speculation, untied from calculation and precise observation, were declared out of bounds. Quote, Aristotle, like Plato too, to some extent before him, was engaged in establishing and validating a new style of inquiry. They were both concerned to recommend the pursuit of philosophy, as they each construed it. And in Aristotle's case, that would include also his conception of natural science. But this inquiry into nature had, he believed, to be given a firm foundation. It is for that purpose, especially, that he insists that, at least from the point of view of his ideal, there can be no room for the metaphorical. Yet this new style of inquiry not only set itself high standards, impossibly high ones, we might think, but it also negatively and destructively ruled out much of the competition as failing in precision, in clarity, in the direct, the literal. End quote. Indeed, Aristotle's rigor was to rule out significant features of Plato's work, including the whole theory of forms. But, even so, their polemical victory on behalf of philosophy against forms of thinking common in the arts, in oral cultures, and among competing sophists, all dismissed as mythic, generated a new faith, quote, that was and remains the basis of scientific thought, that the visible world conceals a rational and intelligible order, end quote. This victory identified and established the method of discovering that order and the language in which it could be expressed. What we see through Plato's and Aristotle's promotion of philosophic thinking is its intense and systematic development and its claim to provide a privileged view of reality and an exclusive path to truth. Let me leap over other ancient civilizations then, including the Roman Empire, pausing at the Renaissance of the 12th and 13th centuries, only to note the influence of the rediscovery of Aristotle's writings, and rumination and commentaries on them by Arabic and Jewish scholars. When the Christian West, the parables of Christ that conveyed the essence of his teaching were reformulated into the abstract, theoretic theology of the medieval schools and universities. From the illiterate kingdoms of Europe, it is possible to trace, as Vico argues, a recorso of the Greek experience, whereby the oral and mythic gave way to, quote, ratios scientiam quarens, reason seeking out knowledge, end quote. The next definitive clarification and refinement of philosophic understanding is most easily seen in the 17th through 19th centuries in Europe. The early and commonly recognized avatars of this development include René Descartes, 1596 to 1650, and the odd Englishman Francis Bacon, 1561 to 1626. Bacon's upbringing, by an earnestly Puritan mother and a father intent on making him every inch a worldly courtier, perhaps encouraged his enormously flexible and powerful intellect, and perhaps even prepared him for his remarkable rollercoaster career in the treacherous years of Elizabethan and Jacobean politics. When compelled to resign the chancellorship in 1621 for accepting bribes, Bacon rather engagingly argued in his defense that he never let the bribes affect his judgment of cases. While only a part-time practical scientist himself, Bacon set out in powerful terms the program that a new science had to pursue. He used his periods in power to propose, without much practical success, that scientific research needed to be organized on a large scale and be lavishly financed. Underneath the theorizing of Bacon and Descartes was the continuing development of the printing press. The print shops, as Elizabeth Eisenstein has shown, from the earliest days began to accumulate around them communities of scholars and stimulated, through their subscription lists, a wider virtual community around Europe. This virtual community was made up of varied smaller communities, some attached to universities, some to metropolitan centers, and later to their coffee houses, salons, or wine shops, and some encouraged by monarchs. Few monarchs, though, had quite the enthusiasm for the new learning as Queen Christina of Sweden, her insistent invitations to Descartes, and then the rigorous schedule she kept him to in the rough Stockholm climate, managed to kill him. In England, the most famous of these scholarly groups was given a charter, but no cash, by Charles II in 1662, and became the Royal Society of London. The lack of government cash did mean that the members retained their political independence. Joseph Addison took some delight in passing on the suggestion that Richelieu had founded the French Academy in 1634, quote, to divert the men of genius from meddling with politics, end quote. The Czech scholar Comenius dedicated his 1668 treatise Via Lucius, quote, to the torchbearers of this enlightened age, members of the Royal Society of London, now bringing real philosophy to a happy birth, end quote. Bishop Thomas Spratt, an early member of the society and its first historian, noted that its aims were not only the advancement of science, but also the improvement of, quote, the English tongue, particularly for philosophic purposes, end quote. What was needed for real philosophy to advance was a pure, unpoetic, simple, unambiguous prose, something close to a mathematical plainness that would reflect the natural world like a mirror. The society's overall aim, though many of the early members were clerics, was to achieve a more general truth than religious controversy allowed. Quote, for they openly profess not to lay the foundation of an English, Scotch, Irish, Popish, or Protestant philosophy, but a philosophy of mankind, end quote. Spratt also emphasizes the importance of communal activity. Quote, nor is it the least commendation the Royal Society deserves that designing a union of men's hands and reasons, it has proceeded so far in uniting their affections. For there we behold an unusual sight to the English nation, that men of disagreeing parties and ways of life have forgotten to hate, and have met in the unanimous advancement of the same works. There the soldier, the tradesman, the merchant, the scholar, the gentleman, the courtier, the divine, the Presbyterian, the papist, the independent, and those of orthodox judgment have laid aside their names of distinction and calmly conspired in a mutual agreement of labors and desires. For here they do not only endure each other's presence without violence or fear, but they work and think in company and confer their help to each other's inventions. End quote. While the kind of thinking Plato and Aristotle bequeathed to modern Europe assumed a somewhat distinctive form in the real philosophy of empirical science, the same impulses to establish the truth about reality with rigorous theoretic clarity were evident in the humanities generally, and also in reflection on everyday affairs. Dictionaries, Dr. Johnson's was published in 1755, and encyclopedias, Ephraim Chambers's appeared in 1728, influencing the indomitable Denis Diderot, and the great French Encyclopédie, whose philosophy contributors aimed to change the way people thought, supported the process of clarification, precision, ordering, and accessibility of knowledge. The entry under philosophy in the encyclopedia notes, quote, reason is to the philosophy what grace is to the Christian, end quote. During the 18th century, a growing community wanted to discuss topical issues, literature, art, economics, history, and politics, in a manner that more nearly matched the seriousness, precision, and authority of the scientists. Examples of this theoretic philosophic discourse, addressed to a wide virtual community in a style like Thucydides, written with an eye to a permanence beyond coffeehouse opinion, found a home in the great reviews of the late 18th and early 19th centuries. The Analytical Review, founded by a radical young Scotsman, Thomas Christie, and by Joseph Johnson, a book dealer, the father of the book trade, and publisher, ran from 1788 to 1799. The Edinburgh Review was founded on a stormy night in March 1802, on the third floor of 18 Bluecliffe Place, Edinburgh, and the Quarterly Review followed in 1809. The contributions of the last two in particular did not succeed in calmly conspiring in a mutual agreement like the scientists, as the two reviews reflected Whig and Tory party interests, respectively. But by 1812, they had an estimated joint readership of around 100,000, each selling more than 12,000 copies per issue. Quote, to be an Edinburgh reviewer is, I suspect, the highest rank in modern literary society, end quote, wrote Hazlitt. And around the reviews were communities of talkers, whose conversations were encouraged to use the philosophic discourse exemplified by the reviewers. Perhaps the most brilliant was Sidney Smith, another cleric and a prime mover of the Edinburgh Review, who moaned loudly when dragged back to his parishes from the magic square mile around Holland House, and whose startlingly lively wit was such that people rushed home after conversing with him to write down what he had said, fortunately for us. Smith's clean, sharp, abrupt style seems entirely modern, as do many of his sentiments. How can we think of as anything other than a contemporary, a person who said, quote, I am not fond of expecting catastrophes, but there are cracks in the world, end quote. The philosophic note can be found in all areas of inquiry. Edward Gibbon published the first volume of his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire in 1776, to near universal acclaim. The clergy, notably, were reluctant to see Christianity treated as a villain of the peace. Gibbon had been influenced by the philosophies, particularly Montesquieu. Quoting David Womersley's 1989 book on the writing of The Decline and Fall, John Kenyon notes, quote, "The philosophic historian hopes to dissolve the surface of historical change and thereby reveal the unchanging principles governing human society and action." End quote. This philosophic ambition gathers force in the history writing of the 19th century. The great figure of Leopold von Ranke reformed historical research, claiming that it was only by meticulous care in uncovering the particulars of past events, for their own sake, that the development of the world in general will become apparent. If Thucydides' conception of history was tragic, Ranke's is comic. He presents a general image of the historical process as a God-guaranteed progress of the nation-states toward unity and harmony. For the pure philosophic inquirer of the Enlightenment, all general questions have a single, true answer. These answers are in principle discoverable and knowable, and each answer will be compatible with all other answers, composing a single, correct, coherent view of the cosmos, which we will share with God. Through the 19th century, communities and institutions supporting philosophic discourse increased. Quote, "Not since the genius of the 17th century, virtuosi, stirred learned imaginations, had so many eloquent voices praised the cause of science," end quote. As Hayden White observes, quote, 19th century European culture displayed everywhere a rage for a realistic apprehension of the world," end quote, that its philosophic forms of inquiry were intent on supplying. So John Stuart Mill could write, quote, "The supremely important fact of our era, the gradual reduction of all phenomena within the sphere of established law, which carries as a consequence the rejection of the miraculous, has its determining current in the development of physical science. The great conception of universal regular sequence could only grow out of the patient watching of external fact, and the silencing of preconceived notions, which are urged upon the mind by the problem of physical science," end quote. Mill was influenced by and repaid by financially supporting Auguste Comte, 1798-1857, the French philosopher and social theorist who invented the term sociology and described the process whereby it was to be made scientific. Comte also gave an elaborate programmatic outline of positivism in his sixth volume, Cours de Philosophie Positive, 1830-1842. He argued that the human mind and cultural history has passed through three inevitable, irreversible stages, theological, metaphysical, and positive. Positivism is marked by the final recognition that science provides the only valid form of knowledge and that facts are the only possible objects of knowledge. Philosophy is thus recognized as essentially no different from science, except that its task is to seek more generally for principles common to all sciences and use these principles to guide human conduct and the organization of society. Ethics, politics, social interactions, and all other forms of human life about which knowledge was possible would eventually be drawn into the orbit of science, become thereby properly ordered, and so lead to universal human betterment. Though Comte, at age 14, had announced to his ardently Catholic family that he had naturally ceased to believe in God, his image of the world and the new humanity to be created by the application of positive science had a considerable romantic and religious tinge and was described by Thomas Huxley as Catholicism without Christianity. 19th century positivism was one direction taken by philosophic understanding. The positivist program for mapping the inexorable and immutable laws of matter and society seemed to allow no greater role for the contribution of poets than had Plato. The poets, however, had a counterclaim to make. During the early part of the century, they had asserted powerfully that access to truth and knowledge were far from exclusively achieved by reason and science. Perhaps the most cogent and comprehensive statement of poetry's claims on truth is Shelley's Defense of Poetry, written in 1821 and first published in 1840, in which he argues, quote, "Poetry is at once the center and circumference of knowledge. It is that which comprehends all science, and that to which all science must be referred," end quote. He concludes that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. These claims, however, are stated in abstract theoretic terms, no less philosophic than the more prolix claims of Comte, Mill, and Herbert Spencer. That is, distinctions among Enlightenment, Romanticism, and Post-Romanticism, which have played a large part in categorizing cultural history, are not very significant from the perspective of these kinds of understanding. Certainly, we find clear cases of romantic understanding in Romanticism, but we will also find that the leading romantic writers routinely used features of philosophic understanding, particularly when arguing on behalf of the propriety of their poetic program of exploration. We will find, that is to say, all five kinds of understanding interleaved in complex historical movements, sometimes one kind showing more prominently, sometimes another. What Plato represented as the quarrel between philosophy and poetry is resuscitated in the two cultures quarrel of more recent times between the humanities and the sciences. Both sides have conducted their quarrel in philosophic terms, both building their arguments rationally and constructing theoretic positions. The polemical beginnings of the quarrel were tied to claims about what kind of education best formed the mind. After all, for much of their lives, Plato and Aristotle were professional educators. The two cultures' quarrel of recent years continues a debate that has long had as one of its important implications the appropriate structure of the school and university curriculum. What deserves greater attention, the sciences or the humanities? Which is more important for the development of the mind? As with most educational questions, these have run into a general impasse. Solutions are compromises that seem to do justice to neither side of the quarrel and to satisfy no one. This state of affairs is a result, I think, of our current incoherent conception of education, which allows no adequate handle on the quarrel. The quarrel is seen as a battle for the human soul, or, which is much the same thing, a battle over how we should educate the young. The scientist side of the argument is commonly pressed in a regrettable tone that contains a regrettable truth, as in this recent example. Quote, "Science involves an unnatural mode of thought which alienates and humiliates those who are ignorant of it." End quote. It follows that those who are ignorant of science can have nothing of value to contribute. This dismissiveness can easily be read as a know-all, imagine-nothing style. And the claims of imagination and the shadowy things, inaccessible to the methods of inquiry available to scientists, are reasserted as central to a full human life and education. But it is inappropriate to call philosophic understanding unnatural, as Wolpert describes the empirical science form of it, echoed in the title of his 1992 book, The Unnatural Nature of Science, any more than it would be to call mythic or romantic or ironic understanding unnatural. Rather, one might better say it is not a kind of thinking or understanding that is usually developed in any systematic way apart from communities or institutions dedicated to encouraging it. Like the other kinds of understanding, it is relatively easy to acquire if one is in an environment that insistently uses it. It requires the mediational means of a consistent and persistent theoretic discourse.